December 2nd, 1968, which was the first day I had to act as acting president of San Francisco State. I had been appointed 6 days earlier, and I had spent much of those 6 days in conference with Mayor Alioto of San Francisco and Chief of Police Thomas Cahill. And you know the deep prejudice against any academic person having anything to do with the police. But I felt profoundly that the situation at San Francisco State, already closed down by a strike, had to be confronted, since we are having force used against us by the force on the other side. Seems only to make a little bit of sense. My predecessor as president has just resigned 6 months after his appointment. It was widely said when I was appointed that I would be lucky to last 3 weeks in my job. In fact, I was told that there was a meeting of the teachers' union at which it was announced I was appointed acting president, and the whole meeting burst into roars and roars of laughter. Now, there are two reasons that I believe that the college managed to remain open during the crisis winter of 68-69. The first is a matter of policy, and the second is a matter of luck. The policy was my decision to have police on campus, not before disturbances began, but before. On every campus, they used to have big debates. Things are in uproar in the gymnasium, they're in an uproar in the political science building. Is it time to call the police? And I decided, that's nonsense. You have it beforehand. And so when students and professors began to arrive at 8 o'clock on the morning of December 2nd, they were greeted at the entrance of every classroom building by 8 police officers in various entrances, who said, "Good morning, sir. Good morning, ma'am," to the students and professors as they came in. And some students were flabbergasted and some were very, very pleased. But they knew that the new state of affairs had gone into being. And from that moment on, there were no more organized squads of goons going from classroom to classroom demanding under threats of violence that classes be dismissed. Most of the uproar was internal. I mean, these radical students would bust up classrooms, threaten students and teachers. They would burst into departmental offices, throw typewriters out of windows, smash up the office machinery, pull the files, file drawers out of the files and dump them on the floor, and do all sorts of nice little things like that. But after the police were stationed around every classroom building, all that sort of nonsense stopped. Now, the unfortunate effect of all this was that because uproar could not be conducted within the campus, it had to be within the buildings, it had to be conducted in the open air in the central campus. Now, from the point of view of television, the lighting is much better outside than it is inside. And so the demonstrations centered on the central campus, with the result that the outside world began to feel that the things at San Francisco State College had gone to hell in a big way, because they saw so much more going on television. But actually, from December 2nd onward, the integrity of the classroom began to be tested. no matter what they showed on television. And I believe that I was right to use the police under those circumstances. Now, as for the element of luck, as I looked out of my office window before classes began that morning, and that's before 8 o'clock on December 2nd, and boy, it takes an awful lot of emergency to get me up before 8 o'clock, I saw on campus groups of students distributing leaflets. And some were radical students saying, stay away from class, support the strike, and others were pro-administration students saying, go to class, try to keep the educational process going. So as I looked out the window, I thought, well, I'd go shake hands with some of the pro-administration students. And as I walked out, I began to hear from way over here, loudspeaker system. Now, I had said the loudspeaker systems are not to be used on campus because we're trying to restore quiet and order. And this was a very straightforward directive which was in my power to give as president of the institution. So I walked up, first putting on my tam o' shanter, which is a sort of personal talisman and a memento that I wear, a memento of my Canadian upbringing, which I wear for fishing, sports car driving, and reopening universities. Well, you already saw it. Now, in reopening the campus under these emergency commissions, as I said, I had issued temporary regulations saying no bullhorns, no loudspeaker equipment. But there was that loudspeaker blaring away somewhere on campus. And I hastily looked around and I found it came from a sound truck parked at 19th Avenue and Holloway, where students pour out of streetcars on their way to class. And so I went over to the sound truck and tried to say as politely as possible to the two young men who were in the cab that there were these new regulations and therefore would you please turn it off. They ignored me. As a matter of fact, they slammed the door in my face and said, well, I won't quote exactly. So I asked if I might use the sound equipment to announce the regulations to the gathering crowd, and then said that again. So, you know, what do you do? I climbed on the back of the sound truck to speak to the crowd, and when I began to do so, the sound truck operators began to scream into the speaker system to drown out my voice. And so I looked quickly around me, and there were wires leading from the back of the cab up to the loudspeakers, and so I just yanked them out. Now, meanwhile, other people had also climbed onto the truck. I was being pushed, and so I pushed back in return. I remember one especially formidable-looking bearded youth who approached me, and as I shrank back in some trepidation, he took my arm and said, don't be afraid, Dr. Hackaw, I'm your friend. So I haven't judged by appearances ever since. And he and others helped me off the truck, and I quickly got back to my office with an escort. And the whole incident took no more than, 7 or 8 minutes. It was an impulsive and futile gesture on my part. I got nowhere. And it would have remained a futile gesture, I'm sure, were it not for the fact, and this is a very important fact about the times we live in, newsmen, television cameramen, press photographers, dozens of them, predicting that interesting things would happen at the corner of 19th Avenue and Holloway that morning, were there in swarms. In a couple of hours, pictures of me and my tam o' shanter pulling the wires of the soundtrack were on all local TV stations, and within 24 hours they had been shown on national networks all over the United States and on front pages of newspapers around the world. God, it's a nice, nice thing to happen. Because look, up to this point, the picturesque radicals with their beards and their guerrilla theater, they were so attractive from the point of view of visual news reporting to the television reporters that they got all the space and all the time. But suddenly I became an image. It did not matter that that image bore a little resemblance to the kind of person I am. Suddenly I became a symbol of courageous resistance to student anarchy that had been troubling universities from Berkeley to Harvard to Paris to Tokyo. And therefore I also suddenly became hot television news, so that I immediately got equal time or better with the most picturesque and dramatic radical dissidents, whose wild antics and rhetoric had long commanded the airwaves. In fact, they had commanded the airwaves for so long that the public despaired of hearing any other voice. See, when they heard any other voice, which is very rare, they heard other college presidents who didn't do anything very dramatic. They were some nice bureaucratic types, as I have never quite succeeded in being. And after they start speaking their piece on what the administration position was, after 15 seconds, the station cut them off. But anyway, I got a hearing as a result of all this. And congratulatory letters and telegrams began to arrive. Something like 50 pounds of mail a day. And that's when I realized I'd won the propaganda war. And that, in an age of mass communications, is winning the war itself. But I repeat, it was luck. Something has just happened. Because, first of my impulsive act, and second, the nature of the news media of our time. And somehow I stumbled into a situation where I suddenly learned how to use the new media. And I had at that time a public relations man by the name Harvey York. And he knew how to take every possible advantage. And I remember one morning I gave 17 exclusive interviews. And he had these reporters sort of scattered around in different offices around the administration building. I'd go from one to the other, to the other, to the other. And not one of them knew that the 16 others existed. But that news went out not only all over this country, but Japan and Germany and France and every other kind of place. And this is what it means to win the propaganda war. And the best public relations firm in the country couldn't have planned it better. Now, at the heart of higher education in modern society is an almost irreconcilable conflict between democratic and aristocratic ideals. I think this is our great, great problem. For most of the world's history, higher education was for the few, entitled by birth, or rank, or wealth, to special privilege. And the purpose of education was to create a ruling class. This was very clearly stated in Plato. Now, the ruling class, as the British philosopher Sir Karl Popper says, he explains the educational theories of Plato, the ruling class are not like other men. They belong to another world. They communicate with the divine. Thus, Plato's philosophical education had a definite political function. It establishes a barrier between the rulers and the ruled. And this has remained a major function of higher education down to our own time. Platonic wisdom is acquired largely for the sake of establishing a permanent political class rule. Now, why are the ruling class of another world? And why are they in communication with the divine? Well, because they have knowledge, not opinion. And for those of you who are philosophers, I'm sure you are acquainted with this idea that it's always remained something of great fascination to me. But you and I call knowledge in our pragmatic society that is based on living and experience. Plato refused to dignify by that name. Since knowledge of the transitory and changing world is necessarily also transitory and changing, it's merely opinion. See, what you know about the insurance business, or what you know about atomic structure, or what you know about chemistry, or what you know about the native plants of California, is all opinion, because the world has changed. And what is knowledge then? Well, as Karl Popper explains, Plato conceived the task of pure knowledge, or science, to discover and describe the true nature of things, their hidden reality or essence. Now, what does that mean? These essences may be discovered and discerned with the aid of intellectual intuition. Every essence has a proper name to it, a name by which sensible things are called, and a description of the essence of the thing is called a definition. In brief, it appears that Plato's theory of knowledge is that true knowledge is knowledge of words and their definitions. Not physiology, not engineering, not geography, not chemistry. Particular reference for words like pig or government may change with changing methods of breeding pigs or governing people. But the true essential meanings of these words resist change over time. And Plato believed that true knowledge transcends time and change. Now, if I go through this rather tedious explanation, it's only to account for the most puzzling of modern educational phenomena. Namely, why the most savage and barbaric behavior in recent years of campus turmoil was accepted mostly by professors and students who deal in the most civilized and humanizing disciplines, namely philosophy, literature, and the social sciences. We got more damn Maoists in our philosophy department. Totally out of proportion, out of ratio to the proportion in the population. Why do we have so many Maoists in philosophy and English? And this, since I am a major in philosophy and English, and since I am a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Anthropology, and a fellow of the American Sociological Association, a fellow of the American Psychological Association, the social sciences and humanities are my home base. And I can't help worrying about this. Surely there's nothing in the study of Shakespeare or T.S. Eliot to account for the vandalism and violence we saw at San Francisco State and other institutions in 1968, 69, 70. Surely the social awareness nurtured by the social sciences do not account for the abridging of civil rights and academic freedom of the majority of students and faculty, such as occurred at Harvard, Stanford, Columbia, and I don't know how many other distinguished institutions. I wonder how many of you have noticed, I'm sure you did, that the higher the admission standards of the university, the more likely there was that all hell would break loose. But the horrid fact is that the humanities and the social sciences did indeed release the savagery and tyranny of the minority. Why? And all of us here, as people dedicated one way or another to the intellectual life, have to ask ourselves seriously this question. But because built into our education system is that platonic assumption that knowledge of words is superior to all other kinds of knowledge. And therefore, that masters of the verbal arts, the philosophers, the literary scholars, the political scientists, are entitled to be a ruling class. And you out there, who are carpenters or masons or electricians or body and fender men, we don't know from nothing. We philosophers, social scientists, know how to run the world. And you don't have a right to an opinion. Because after all you are is a body and fender man. And this is in direct contradiction to our Constitution of the United States, which says that the body and fender man has an equal right to a vote. One vote. Just the same as you who are a professor of philosophy, you who are a professor of classics, you who are a professor of political science, we all only got one vote. And from the point of view of intellectual elite, that's unfair. Totally unfair. But from the point of the Constitution of the United States, that's the way it's got to be. And we have to ask ourselves a question, where are we going to stand here? Now this Platonism, still residually present in modern higher education, seems to me what accounts for the intellectual arrogance of what has been called the movement in the 1960s. The university must shut down how we discuss Cambodia. Never mind Shakespeare. Never mind organic chemistry. Never mind home economics. We're going to discuss Cambodia. Why? Well, because we, the ruling class, say so. Henry Cabot Lodge must not be permitted to speak on the campus of Stanford University. Why? Lots of people want to hear him. But he must not be permitted to speak. Well, the reason is, says the same minority, because we are the conscience of the community. And you guys in the College of Business Administration, you people in medical school, you people in College of Engineering, you don't know a damn thing about it. So we, the liberal arts and humanities, are the conscience of the community, and we know. But Henry Cabot Lodge must not be allowed to speak. As of today, fortunately, the era of the tyranny of these sophomore Platonic philosopher kings seems to be over. But we must not forget the dynamics that produced it. It is the scorn of the intellectual for the otherwise intelligent. Have you ever been in the cockpit of a jet plane? And you may, and I may have PhDs in economics, philosophy, Elizabethan literature, so on. But damn it, whoever reads all of the instruments in the cockpit of a 727 is a half an intelligent man. Or at least he's had some terrific training. You have to have a certain amount of humility about the fact that he is an intelligent man within his own field. But think of the scorn of the intellectual for the otherwise intelligent. It's Jack Barzan, provost of Columbia University, saying contemptuously of painters, sculptors, engineers, and scientists that, quote, they don't need discursive intellect, some scarcely need literacy. Well, I don't give a damn if Juan Miró can read or write or not. He's a great, great sculptor and a great, great painter, is he not? I don't care if Matisse, no, can't compose an essay, he can. But if he couldn't, you still need a very, very great painter indeed, you know. and bring it right down to our own home institutions. This snobbery is a scorn of the teacher in the college preparatory program in the community college for his colleagues in the vocational arts. I teach English, you teach horticulture. I am superior to you. And you see this division in one damn community college after another. Now the political idea of, the platonic idea of political arts, says Karl Popper, is a kind of herdsmanship, i.e. the art of managing and keeping down the human cattle. And his idea of a liberal education is that we should be the herdsmen, managing and keeping down the human cattle, you know, who work in horticulture and insurance and business administration and importing and exporting and so on. All these low occupations, which are below, which are unworthy of the attention of the philosopher and the gentleman. Good enough. But we have to dedicate ourselves to the fact that we, in America, live in a country where there are no human cattle, where the body and fender man and the teamster have the same political voice as the literary critic or the sociologist, or the expert on T.S. Eliot. And our educational system should reflect this fact. This is a great, great problem. I was having a big discussion of this yesterday with Dr. Kevin Starr, who is the author of a book called Americans in the California Dream. He said, is there an irreconcilable conflict between excellence and democracy? And he says there is only under the following circumstances. If, let us say, I'm a professor of English, and you are a stonemason, and you are a CPA, and you are an insurance broker, excellence means that I'm one hell of a good English professor, you're a good stonemason, you're a good insurance broker, you are good at whatever you do, you're a hell of a carpenter, and excellence means excellence in all these areas. But supposing you work out a caste system in which you say a lousy professor of English is by definition superior to a first-rate mason or stonecutter. A lousy professor of English is by definition superior to an insurance adjuster, no matter how good an insurance adjuster he is. Then we are introducing into America a caste system that our Constitution does not allow. And therefore, Dr. Kevin Starr said, let's acknowledge the fact that we can have excellence and elitism. You as an insurance adjuster, you as a stonemason, you as a body and fender man, you're tops in your profession, just as I'm tops in my profession as a professor of English. And we're all equal. And if democracy does not allow for top-level achievement, at the same time as it recognizes top-level achievement, then it ceases to be democracy. Once we begin to classify different occupations as one being more worthy than the other. in Honolulu, not
too long ago,
an individual of definite pro-communist sympathies was making such a radical uproar that his dismissal was demanded by the local Lions Club. Now, the response of the professor's colleagues was to grant him tenure. Not because they admired him or agreed with him, but damn it, they weren't going to be dictated to by a middle-class outfit like the Lions Club. Now, this incident points to the heart of the problem of many universities, the old conflict between town and town. The Lions, of course, are profoundly the middle class, but professors in some departments, most notably in the humanities and social sciences, believe it almost a religious duty to inculcate in their students a contempt for middle-class values. So if a middle-class outfit like Lions Club says, this radical professor's got to be fired, you just have to stand for your own values. It's kind of intellectual aristocracy, you do not bow down to the Lions Club. 3 years later, I met the people in that department again, and it turns out to be a lousy teacher and no scholar, but they've got to keep giving him tenure. Nobody else will take him, so they're stuck with him for the next 30 years because he's only a man of about 35. Wow. But a difficult contradiction arises from the fact that universities are profoundly middle-class institutions. Middle-class parents send their sons and daughters to college to reaffirm and strengthen their middle-class status. And working-class people go to the university in order to join the middle class. And basically the function, especially of our publicly supported institutions of higher learning, is the, our basic function is the middle classification for everybody, which is not very different from the Marxist dream of a classless society. But, as I say, professors who despise the middle class are essentially aristocratic and out there. And they're in a very difficult position. Let me quote one of them. A typical example is a man by the name of Kingsley Widmer, professor of English at San Diego State University, who wrote an article in The Nation not long ago, which recently came to my attention. This is what he says. Except for the younger and often more intellectual active faculty in the social sciences and the humanities, the California State Universities are institutions in which mediocrity is the end as well as the rule. The faculty, he says, is dominated by a large anti-intellectual emphasis upon schools of education, business administration, industrial arts, and other sub-academic activities. Now, of course, this is the typical liberal arts arrogance. According to this view, only in liberal arts, and possibly in political science and anthropology, is there any intellectual life. What goes on in your school of nursing? What goes on in your school of business administration? What goes on in your school of engineering or your college of agriculture? These are all sub-academic. And beneath contempt. The state colleges, Widmer continues, carry on the main work of technical training and indoctrination for submissive service in the middle range of corporate and state hierarchies. In other words, state colleges, instead of training people to become gentlemen, connoisseurs of literature, critics of society, revolutionaries, or philosopher kings, undertake the ignominious task of preparing people for jobs in industry and government. How shameful. How ignominious. Well, no, you worry about a guy like this Professor Widmer. He must indeed be a miserable man. He despises the very raison d'etre of the institution he works for as a tenured professor of English. He views the trustees and the governor as busy manipulating the system so that, quote, The economically privileged shall keep full power over education and withdraw its access from the socially and politically unsubmissive, unquote. He despised administrators who are to him the super janitors who run the colleges. That's me. He scorns most of his professorial colleagues and their sub-academic concerns. And one wonders why the hell he deigns to remain at such a miserable institution. Except that that's the only place he can get a job, I guess. Well, what is our job, anyway? I remember following one of our recent commencement exercises, I was approached by a man, this is our reception following the commencement, by a man who introduced himself as a skycap at the San Francisco International Airport. And he said, "You don't know me, but I've often carried your baggage." And then he proudly introduced me to his wife, his younger children, and finally his eldest son, who had just graduated with a degree in business administration and was on a threshold of a career very different from his father's. Well, I must say I was proud of that graduate in business administration and the sacrifices his family made to get him through college. I'm equally proud of our graduates in English literature, the social sciences, nursing, chemistry, or anything else we teach. But no doubt a guy like Professor Widmer will find the achievements of that graduate in business administration sub-academic and beneath contempt. And what I want to know, and I don't know the answer to it to this day, is why so many scholars in the liberal arts and the humanities appear to have their own humanity and human sympathies diminished rather than broadened by their humanistic studies. How does this happen? You don't want me to go on forever, do you?
Yeah.
All right, I'll go on forever since you insist. All right, let me. You have other meetings scheduled. Okay. All right, let me talk about one other thing that's bothered me very much. It's a matter for our culture as a whole. If I may change the subject abruptly, I want to talk about obscenity and pornography. You know, as people discuss these matters, there is widespread confusion as to how to approach the problem, and I'd like to talk about this. Let me distinguish that first between sexual behavior on the one hand and what it means to the participants. And then there's the outside observer of that sexual behavior, looking at it and what it means to him. Now, when a man and a woman make love, enjoying themselves and each other fully and unselfconsciously, a rich relationship is made richer and reaffirmed by their lovemaking. We all know this. Now, however beautiful and sacred that love relationship may be to these two people, to a peeping Tom secretly watching the proceedings from outside the window, it has a totally different meaning. Now, sexual behavior itself is not obscene. Obscenity is peculiarly the evaluation of an outside observer. Now, let's turn this around a bit and play with a theory. Theoretically, you can make the participants also the observers. Let's, in imagination, have these two people making love, and secretly a camera, a movie camera, is recording everything they do. And then later on, we show the movie to the couple. I'm sure that under those conditions, the lovemaking would take on a different meaning. That which is performed unselfconsciously and spontaneously may be viewed later by the actors themselves with giggling or shame or outright shock. Is it not? And they may even insist that the film be destroyed, which is a very different thing from saying they're going to not make love anymore. And I call your attention to this because I want to call it attention to the difference between acts and spectators of those acts. That obscenity and pornography then can happen only when sexual events are seen from the outside from a spectator's point of view. And this appears to me the crux of the pornography problem. Pornography is obscenity made public through symbolization, by representation in literature, by simulation or enactment in a nightclub act, or on stage, or by such arts as painting, photography, or the movies. Now, to object to pornographic art is not, as some people would have us believe, the result of having hang-ups about sex. You can have no hang-up about sex whatsoever and still object to their representation in any of these arts. That's a different matter. And here I want to introduce another distinction. The distinction between morality on the one hand and decorum on the other. For example, there's nothing immoral about changing one's clothes or evacuating one's bowels. We do this every day. But in our society, people normally do not change their clothes in the presence of the other sex, except perhaps their spouses. And so far as going to the lavatory, men and women have separate public lavatories, and within each of these, there is a separate compartment for privacy. It's all right to evacuate your bowels, but there's no, you know, you feel a little bit unhappy about having it shown on a nationwide network. Now, it's a very curious fact about lovemaking, is that love needs privacy. Human beings normally make love in private. Whether that love is socially sanctioned as in marriage or totally unsanctioned as in a house of prostitution. Now, the trouble with sexual intercourse as an object of artistic representation is this. That the meaning is not apparent in the behavior. Hence, good writers have historically been reticent in their descriptions of sex. Some of you may remember in Dante's Divine Comedy that Paolo tells of his tragic love for Francesca. He was Francesca's tutor. And they were reading an ancient romance. And as they read this book, their passions suddenly overcame them. Now, what happened next? Dante doesn't say. He simply has Paolo say in the poem, "That night we read no further. All the rest is left to the reader's imagination." And the reader cannot help feeling the power of that onrushing, fatal passion. It was so tragic to both of them. The reader has to describe what went on. The impact is there. Now when you think about it, men and women couple with each other for a wide variety of reasons. Sometimes a sexual encounter is the fulfillment of true love and respect of two people for each other. Sometimes a sexual encounter is merely an expression of drunken irresponsibility. A couple hardly know each other, but they're both drunk. Sometimes it's an expression of one of the partners using sex as an instrument of aggression or exploitation against the other. Sometimes a sexual act is a commercial transaction with either party being prosecuted. Sometimes sex is the expression of neurosis. And sometimes sex is the expression of the fact that you're getting over your neurosis. But notice this, that to a peeping Tom, as to a movie camera, they're all doing the same thing. That's what I mean when I say that the meaning is not apparent in the behavior. Therefore, to concentrate on the mechanics of sex is to ignore altogether its human significance. Now, we are confronted today with a situation in which movies do not stop at exhibiting copulation. Every kind of aberrant sexual behavior and sadomasochistic perversion is being shown. The advertisements announced in the newspapers in San Francisco for this week, Last Tango in Paris, Nude Encounter, Too Hot to Handle, Deep Throat, The Exorcist, The Devil and Miss Jones, The Passion Parlor, Hot Kitten, Honeymoon Suite, and 16 Hours of Hardcore Male Stags. Aren't you glad you came here for your convention? Now, the only purpose of movies such as these, from all I can tell from the advertisements and the reviews, is, as D.H. Lawrence expressed it, to do dirt on sex. And so if the American Civil Liberties Union wants to fight for the right of these movies to be shown, I say let them. But I sure as hell will not. Thank you all very much.
At the University of Chicago was at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And at that time, President Hayakawa was, I believe, a professor of English. And that's the first time I met him. I'm sure he didn't know who I was. I already knew who he was. And he reminded me of something that I regret to say I have forgotten. And that is that during those years, just after the Second World War, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, Professor Hayakawa was very well known in the city of Chicago for giving fabulous lectures on jazz. And at that time, he was very instrumental in introducing to the white population of the city of Chicago and to the world people such as Mahalia Jackson, who later went on to such worldwide recognition. And among other things, I think we owe him a great debt of gratitude for that as well. Thank you very much. I think we'll have about a 15-minute break, and our next session will start. It is now 20 minutes of three. Today we'll start in about 5 minutes of three at our final session.
Thank you very much. I'm done. If you're here, can you stay for any of the further sessions?
I didn't catch what they said when I lost.
Oh, Zebras, California.
Yeah. Southern Cal.
Oh.